Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Don't touch that dial. Today, our guest on QSO is shortwave radio legend Alan Weiner, the man who created WBCQ. We'll be right back with our guest Alan Weiner right after this on QSO. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support.com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. With us, joining us now this hour, is Alan Weiner. Alan, are you there?
I am here.
And how are you this evening?
I am great. How are you, Ted?
I'm doing good. I want to say, folks, for people who, and I can't imagine you listening to this radio station and not knowing who Alan is, The thing that intrigues me about Alan Weiner is he has consistently, I guess, I don't know. I think he was born and they handed him a bottle with a radio attached to it or something like that. Something happened that way. He's been around the radio business all his life. And as far as I'm concerned, he's the one individual that I know of, the only individual I know of, that has changed the face of shortwave radio as well as broadcast radio in a lot of different ways. And his life path has taken him down many journeys. And we want to talk about that a little bit. He's currently the owner, obviously, of WBCQ. And what a fine shortwave radio station, a station that is so diverse in programming. It's not 24-hour-a-day preaching. It's not foreign language all the time. It's a little bit of everything. It's a cross-section of America, really, is what it is. It's folks from all over the country, different walks of life, different professions, different beliefs, have all gathered together under one roof to form this very unique radio station, WBCQ. And this is all a product, of course, of the dedication and determination of one Alan Weiner. Alan, I want to start here. I want you to tell, what in the world ever got your attention? How did you happen onto radio? What was it that sparked your interest in this?
Well, it's just sheer madness, Ted. It's like an infection, and it got into me at a very, very young age. The desire to communicate through the air using electromagnetic radiation. I was always the technical person in school. I was one of the technical nerds growing up in elementary school and in high school. And I was always fascinated by radio and television. And my father and mom, you know, we always had radio and televisions and hi-fi sets, and my father used to tinker around with stereo equipment, which was becoming very popular in the 50s. You know, hi-fi was the big thing going on back then. And there was this mysterious band of frequencies known as shortwave. And my dad once got himself a shortwave radio, a small little Channel Master portable. And one night, you know, when I was a very, very young kid, I was in his bedroom and he was tuning across the bands, and all these weird and wonderful sounds and foreign language shortwave stations were just pouring in our Yonkers, New York home. And so I was always fascinated with it. But I tell this story a lot, but what really got me interested in broadcasting was, I believe I must have been, I don't know, 14, 15 years old. And I lived in Yonkers, New York, which is a big, you know, city town about 10 miles north of New York City. River town, right on the Hudson River. Actually, it used to be a beautiful place. It's, you know, kind of urbanified now, but growing up there was pretty cool. But one night, as I said, it must have been 14 or 15, there was a special on television, on the NBC television network. They did a documentary on early broadcasting, early radio in this country. And it was a very well-made documentary. I've never seen it again. You know, I've looked for it on all the various archives out there, but it was done, you know, like, this is, what was it, 1966, 1967, something like that. They did a documentary on broadcasting, and they went back to the origins of American broadcasting, which started, you know, in 1920 with the first KDKA broadcast. And they went through the 30s and the 40s, which were kind of the golden era of radio broadcasting here in the United States. And I was just glued to the television set in absolute fascination. Because in the 60s, radio was basically a jukebox at that time. You know, after World War II, when television really took off, most radio stations went to the disc jockey format. Of course, in the New York area, you had a wide variety of various radio stations. But as a kid in school, we knew radio stations basically as those that played music or football or baseball games, and that was about it. But this documentary was featuring stations from the 20s and 30s that were before television, where radio was just that radio in the corner of the living room or the parlor was the main fixture in the home.
And radio programs came from studios where people actually dressed in suits and ties and stood behind microphones and read scripts and gave cue signals across the room.
Yeah, but they just didn't play music. They created all of this art and drama and information. So people in the golden age of radio in the 1920s, the guy would come home from work and have dinner with his wife and kids, and then they'd all, go into the parlor or go into the living room and crowd around the radio set and, listen to The Shadow and The Lone Ranger and Mystery Theater and the news and all this, and they just sat there, and the radio was it, and all of this drama and all of this creative, electromagnetic juice would paint pictures in their mind, and it was the thing. And I remember I was listening to that, and of course this was the time, this was like the late 60s, and this was the time when there was a lot of unrest among my generation. The Vietnam War was becoming relatively unpopular. A lot of my friends and a lot of people in my peer group were becoming dissatisfied with what was going on, what they were seeing their government doing, the establishment. And I'm watching this special and I'm saying to myself, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to build and operate radio stations so I can put people on the air to talk about important things that are going on so people will know about them. That's what I felt. That's how I felt. People would say, when I was getting into radio and building radios and fixing radios and whatever, everyone was telling me, well, you should become a ham radio operator. And I would say, well, what can you do? And they'd say, well, you talk to people over the world, which is fantastic. But it was a two-way thing. I said, well, can you broadcast? No, you can't broadcast at all. It is strictly forbidden. So I said, well, I don't want to deal with that because I just got this broadcaster thing in my blood. And I saw this special on NBC television, and that cemented it. And then I began to do research and figure out, well, how can you build a radio station? Of course, the first thing I found out is that it is a tremendously government-controlled thing. And building a radio station, especially in the New York City area, is no small task, especially for someone that's 14, 15 years old. In fact, it's near high to impossible. No, in fact, it is impossible. So I began to do more research on it, and I said, well, wait a minute. I went to the library, got all the books on transmitters, equipment, all this stuff. We had a great library in Yonkers, which unfortunately they bulldozed. It was a Carnegie Library, beautiful building, which, of course, the city of Yonkers bulldozed in their idiocy. And had a beautiful technical section, and I'd go there and take out all these books. That's how I taught myself everything I pretty much know about electronics and radio. Read up on transmitters and studio equipment and all this, and I said, well, I can probably do something with military surplus electronics, because there was a lot of that in the late 60s still available from World War II. And I said, well, this is a free speech issue. When you're a young kid, you can justify all this stuff. This was a free speech issue. So I said, even though you're supposed to have a license for it, if I found a frequency that wasn't being used, like 1620 AM, I figured, well, we can put some radio stations on the air and do some local free broadcasting And because it's protected by the First Amendment, it's righteous and correct. And, you know, when you're young, Ted, you're indestructible. So that's what I thought, and that's what I began to do. So in the late 60s, while I was still in high school, I started planning on building and constructing a radio station in my parents' basement of their home on Neyland Avenue in Yonkers, New York. And that's how it started.
You go back to the type of programming, and I mentioned people dressed in suits standing behind microphones. You know, there was actual career radio actors that of course, all the old-time radio shows I know you're totally familiar with. But these people were professional radio actors that acted on radio. And you see those pictures taken of a whole studio full of radio actors behind floor-standing microphones, you know, holding scripts in their hands and whatnot, and producing these incredible radio dramas and radio shows. And then there were travelogue shows on radio where you would hear people. What was the guy's name that was always on from Hawaii? Was it Webley Edwards or something? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, but anyways.
That, I think, was before my time.
Okay, well, I mean, I've heard recordings of the things. Of course, I don't remember it because I wasn't here for it, but I'm like you, going back and understanding the care and the amount of effort that went into producing radio back then is what made it, I think, such a magic media. You know, and you're right, people would come home from work, there would be the radio, the console radio in the corner of the room, and they would turn that radio on and everyone would gather around and listen to the radio.
So, yeah, but it really touched their lives, it really did. Radio is very unique. Broadcasting is a very unique thing. It's where you have a point source transmitter that broadcasts a signal over a wide area to receivers, kind of a one-way thing. But it just has a magicalness to it. And the golden age of radio really touched a lot of people's lives. It still does. I mean, we have, you know, right now, we're doing a similar thing. Right now, we're having a discussion about radio. And there are people all over the world listening to us on all manner and sorts of radio receivers, from small little pocket portables to real fancy, digitally tuned, digital signal processed sets. All over the place. I mean, BCQ's got listeners in the middle of Guatemala, you know, people up in the mountains where their radios are being powered by car batteries. And we're talking about this, and we're touching people's lives, and, you know, no passwords are necessary, no computer connections are necessary. You just fire up the receiver, turn it on, tune in 7415, and you're connected. And we're doing this in real time. This is live. But if you're listening to this on June 12th, which, by the way, today is my birthday.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
Yes, it is.
Well, happy birthday.
Yes, 57 years of absolute sheer madness continue. But, well, yeah, I mean, and radio still does it. You know, it was the golden age in the 30s with all of the radio drama and programs and global forums and news programs, especially right before World War II. But the tradition is still being carried on. It's a magical medium. I mean, I've been in commercial radio all my life, and one of my salespeople, he used to come up to me. He was a great salesman. His name was Tim Giggy. Great radio name. I love that name, Tim Giggy. And he would go out and, you know, sell the radio advertising, and he loved it. And I said, "What do you love about it?" He says, "Alan, I sell magic. I sell magic to people. I mean, you know, here we have this radio station. We're broadcasting music and news and information." This is when I was running a country radio station up in Presque Isle, Maine. And I go out and I sell advertising, but it's magical. I mean, it's, you know, even today, this was the 1980s when things were getting computerized and more sophisticated. It's still magic. Even today, with all this computer and internet wonders, radio is still a magical thing. I mean, you can pull out a receiver, whip out an antenna, and pick a signal up with no wires from a point thousands of miles away in a direct live connection. It's still a magical thing.
Well, when you had your you left off here by saying that you had assembled this radio station in the basement of your home, okay? And I, you know, and it's so funny because I followed a similar path. But there's such,
yes, we're all pyrites at heart.
Yeah, but you know what? I knew that it was illegal, and I knew it was totally against the law, and something in my head just told me, you know, you might be able to get away with this.
Well, in my mind, it was worse than that because I said, this is so good. This is such a great thing that it can't be illegal. It can't. And I justified it by saying, well, I have the knowledge and the technical prowess to get on the air and not cause interference. In other words, do no harm. And that was always on the top of my list as a free radio person. Do no harm. Interfere with no other station or no other service. So when we finally did get on the air, and I guess, what was it, my first station we put on the air in 1968, on 1620 AM, just a crunch above the standard AM broadcast band. Of course, it's the expanded band now, but back then it was just, you know, an unused band of frequencies. I mean, it used to be the old police bands, but they hadn't been used in decades. And that's what we did. I assembled a bunch of World War II Army surplus transmitters in the basement of my dad's house, built a 40-foot whip antenna that I shoved through the roof of the house and insulated, and used the extensive water pipe system of the Yonkers, New York Waterworks as my ground. And we went on the air in, I think it was in September of 1968, we went on the air as WRAD, yes, ingenious call letters there, with 50 watts of power on 1620 AM. And it was myself and a handful of my buddies from high school, and it really created a splash. Yes, it did.
So now, let me ask you this. What kind of coverage did you have with that? I mean, I would think with that, of course, today all the pipes are everywhere PVC, so that wouldn't work. But how did it get out? Where all did you go?
Well, you know, in the daytime, I would say, you know, given our antenna, which, of course, was only 40 feet, wasn't the greatest efficient antenna, even for 1620, but given the 50 watts we had, we covered a good part of South Yonkers, because that's where I was located. You know, all my friends in the neighborhood could pick us up. I know the principal of the high school could receive us, and of course, the government could receive us, so we were putting out. And at night, of course, at night, 1620 was basically a clear frequency. So at night, we were getting out all over the east coast of the United States, even with 50 watts. The first incarnation of our station, when we went on in the 60s, 68, we were on for about, I think, 2 weeks. And the broadcast schedule was kind of, it fit our high school schedule, you know, our school schedule. The station would go on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and go off at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, depending on how much homework I had to do. And finally, we were on, this first incarnation, we were on for about, I think we were on a week, maybe two. And then we got a visit from the FCC.
Well, that didn't take long. Now, today, I would have to say it would be a matter of months, but go ahead.
Well, the thing is, we got busted after the first 2 weeks. And the reason is, is a ham radio operator in high school ratted us out. And I know because he admitted it, and I slugged him in the cafeteria. So, well, that's what happened. And that's why the first WRAD pirate station we were on for 2 weeks, and you know, the FCC got tipped off, and they drove right up there and busted us. And you know, I found out who did it, and he was all self-righteous about it. He said, "Well, you know, I'm a ham radio operator. I'm a guardian of the band, and you know, you shouldn't be on the air without a license." So I belted him, and that was the end of that. And we went on the air, I guess, about a month or two later after that, and pretty much stayed on until we really got busted in August of 1971. But by that time, we had expanded from 1620 AM to FM. We built some FM transmitters, first on 108.1 for about 3 or 4 months with no problem. And by the way, when we went to FM, listenership skyrocketed. Just skyrocketed. Because, you know, think about the time, 1969, 1970, FM radio in the New York City area was becoming the real in thing to listen to. You know, people from my generation were really beginning to tune into FM, even though AM still dominated as far as listener numbers and, of course, revenue. FM was beginning to make serious inroads, and all of the major New York stations were beginning to get all these smooth-talking DJs playing all the new rock and roll music. So we were right there at the right time, and when we started building our FM transmitters, which the first FM transmitter was about 50 watts, and I built a turnstile antenna out of, spare pieces of aluminum tubing I found in the junkyard, and we put all that stuff on the air, and my father's house was at a pretty good elevation in Yonkers. So the signal got out. I mean, we were heard all over the river areas of New Jersey, all over Yonkers, down to Manhattan, into Connecticut, just with 50 watts. And then we rebuilt the transmitters, changed frequency to 87.9, which was a guard frequency between the television stations and the FM band. And we landed on 87.9, and finally, we built transmitters that could do about 250 watts, and we just went, like, you know, 24-7. And we had all kinds of programming. Yeah, we had lots of music, we had news, commentary, and we did stuff, Ted, that all the traditional broadcasters at the time, we were doing talk radio in 1970, 1971, before no one even knew what it was, because we were all about free speech and getting people on the air to express their outrage about what was going on politically, especially with the war in Vietnam. And we had a policy where the telephone lines were always open whenever the stations were on the air. And if somebody called in and if they wanted to be put on the air to have get access on the air immediately, that we would put them on hold, and whatever was playing, whatever music selection was playing, as soon as it finished, we put them on the air and interview them and get their opinions. And this is what we did. This is what the Falling Star Radio Network did with our stations. We had, by the time we were busted in August of 1971, we had four stations going. We had WKOV AM on 1620, WXMN FM on 87.9, and then my partner JP Ferraro had a station in North Yonkers with similar facilities. He was a WFSR AM on 1620, and he was WSEX FM on 87.9, and we would share broadcast nights I'd be on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. He'd be on Tuesday, Thursdays, and Sundays. And the broadcast day pretty much would start at like 6 in the morning and go sometimes all night long, depending on. And we had, you know, by the time we were, it all ended in August of 71, we had like 30 people involved with the station doing programming, doing interviews, you know, drumming up support. It was quite something. And we were building a television station to broadcast on Channel 6.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were doing some experiments with that. We were televising. I had test patterns of electric fans and light bulbs and stuff like that, because television equipment back then was extremely expensive. I mean, it's not like it is now where there's, you know, where there's cameras and everything, you know, from cell phones to shoes. But back then, television equipment was, a lot of it was unobtainium. So we had to build a lot of our stuff and had to build cameras out of World War II surveillance drone cameras and surveillance cameras that we'd get surplus and stuff with Vidicons and iconoscope tubes, because the stuff was just so costly. But we were just getting ready to initiate a television service on Channel 6. And then finally, the government came in and, they really came in and swooped in and arrested us all and confiscated all the equipment. And yes, the happy times were over.
For those who have just tuned in, our guest and who we're speaking with is Alan Weiner, the owner of WBCQ. And if you've tuned in and you're not exactly following this, he's giving us a timeline. Alan is probably one of the, I have to say, the most radio guy I've ever met in my life. He is and has done an incredible amount of service for international shortwave radio. And we're kind of listening to his story, the beginnings of the timeline of his life, I guess I want to say. And it's absolutely, totally fascinating. Well, what do you think happened there? Do you think the government was operating on a tip? Were they monitoring the stations? Was it just typical government BS?
I know exactly what was happening. In that particular case, why we were busted in August, let's see, we were busted August 12th, 1971. They came in with, oh man, federal agents, guns, all kinds of stuff. Woke me up at 5:30 in the morning. Why do they do that? Why do they do that? They woke me up and said, Alan, get out of bed, you're under arrest. And I said, oh, well, this isn't going to be a good day. Well, we know exactly what happened. What happened was, actually the FCC was kind of turning a blind eye to it all. Mainly because there really weren't that many interference complaints, and we were on the air kind of providing a service. But again, it was the ham radio community. Well, I shouldn't say the whole ham radio community, but it was a couple of people in the Yonkers Amateur Radio Club that put on their tin hats, and they were absolutely determined to destroy our radio station. And they kept putting pressure on the this one assistant district attorney in the Southern District of New York to force the FCC to close our stations. And why these guys set it upon themselves to do it, I don't understand. I mean, we found out all the details after we were busted, and to this day, I still say to myself, you know, why do these guys do this?
Well, I want to say this.
We weren't on the ham radio band.
I'm.
We weren't interfering with them. Why did they, you know, set it upon themselves to do this?
I'm not saying
that we wouldn't have been busted eventually. But who knows?
I want to say something here, though, and that is that, you know, we do a lot of amateur radio programming, especially on QSO, and I'm very deeply involved with amateur radio, I guess I want to say. And you know what? Those kind of people are still around. I don't know what makes them tick. I wish they would just go away.
I wish they would, too.
They run good amateurs off the air. Matter of fact,
yes,
I'm just
going to...
Let me just tell you, so you understand that this is not, this is a continuing problem. We had a bunch of blind guys here at the blind school that got their ham licenses. And they got on the radio talking on their HTs and up on the 440 machines here in town. And they were promptly told to get off the band. And I've heard this more than once where it was kind of like, well, the National Weather Service is listening to this frequency. The sun is shining outside. There's not a cloud in the sky. We don't expect any bad weather for the next 100 years, but they are listening. So you have to get off of here because they don't want to hear you talk. Okay, now these variety of people are still around, you know, and I run into them. I was driving through Nashville, and there was a guy had started a weather net, and he started this weather net, and he went into total silence. He hadn't said a word for 5 or 6 minutes, and some guy come in and just popped his call letters in. I mean, obviously, he had just turned his radio on. He listened for a few minutes. He didn't hear anything. He just signed his call. And this guy come out of the woodwork like a bear. There's a weather net in progress, and you're not supposed to be on here unless it's official weather traffic. And I listened to that. I can't believe this, you know. And I shot the guy an email. I shot him a nasty email. I said, you're a disgrace. I said, you don't deserve a license. You need to be off the air. You know, you're rude. And I've seen this. These are self-appointed policemen. If they're on a radio band anywhere and you jump in and talk to them, you may have just taken over their own private frequency that they own, whether you're aware of it or not. They'll let you know. I don't know what makes them tick. They're kind of like security guards that want to be policemen. And unfortunately, in amateur radio, and I want to tell folks, don't get discouraged. You know, when you get into ham radio, you're going to run into a few of these cats. And when you do, you know, the best thing to do is just ignore them. But, of course, in your situation, you couldn't ignore them because they were, once again, they were the self-appointed police officers of the day. And they were making it their business not only to monitor your station but to rat you out and to call the FCC. And I would say they were probably very, very envious and very, very jealous because they themselves were not capable of putting a signal on the air like that. But go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to say I understand this, and that's a real hot button with me. it really is.
Well, I mean, you know, as I said, I do not fault, you know, the amateur radio community because of a few self-appointed tin hat, dictators of authority. I don't do that. But that's the truth. That's really what happened. That's what really brought down the Falling Star Radio Network. And that's history. That's why it happened. And it was a couple of self-appointed enforcers of Yonkers Amateur Radio Club. And again, why they did it, they spent hundreds of hours recording all of our on-the-air programming, which it was published in the newspaper, which they, you know, made all of the recordings available to the government, whatever they needed, and they just kept pressuring the district attorney's office to prosecute us, and all we were doing was on the air playing music, giving people a free speech voice. Probably that in itself was heresy at the time, which it was. We didn't use delays. We let people on the air cold. Language was not really a problem, but every once in a while something slipped through. But remember, Ted, as you said in the beginning, late 60s, early 70s, that was still the jacket tie era of radio broadcasting. Yes, it was. So our stations were definitely an anomaly, definitely a breath of fresh air to many. But we were busted, and after that, it was time to move on. I moved to Maine. I graduated high school, and I said, well, I want to get out of the rat race. So we moved. Oh, boy, did we really get out of it, too. I moved all the way up to northern Maine and settled in a small town called Monticello, and this is, we moved up, we found the place in late August of 1971, and I moved up here in November of 1971, and I eventually enrolled in a small liberal arts college in the Holton, Maine area, known as Ricker College. And, of course, when I got to Ricker College, the first thing I did was build a radio station. It was a carrier current station, but it went more than just the power lines. I mean, most people could pick it up in town. And then I built them an FM radio station, legal this time. And then I built them a television station that we put on cable. And then I had a great time in college, actually. It was a very good thing for me because, actually, when the college found out everything I could do, they eventually hired me to, build them all this stuff and run it. And then they hired me to teach some courses in radio and electronics. So I was one of those kids that I went to college. The college hired me. I got, I got an education while they were paying me. And I got to, go to college tuition free because I was an employee and an instructor running a radio and television department in the school. So it was a great educational experience. I had a lot of fun at Ricker. Sadly, the college was around for 150 years, but they made a lot of bad investments in the 1960s during the draft years. And the college went bankrupt in the mid-1970s, like many small schools did throughout the country back then. I don't know how many people remember that. But and sadly, Ricker had to close in 1978. And when they did, I was out of a job, and I said, well, let me see what I can get into. I mean, I've always been a radio engineer, so I got a job working as the chief engineer for an AM radio station up in Presque Isle, Maine on 1390 with a 5-kilowatt transmitter. So I operated up there for a year or so, and then I built them a 100-kilowatt FM station that they put on the air. And then finally I said, well, enough of this. I'm going to try and go for my own station again, but this time legal. So in, 1980, I bought a small FM station in the Presque Isle area. It was a 3-kilowatt FM on 101.7, and I think I bought it for the incredible sum of $30,000. And I bring that up now because, radio stations are pretty expensive entities. I think I spent $30,000 on that, to which I only had like $2,000 to put towards it. The rest of it, it was carried as a note by the owner, Jack Sieber. I remember that.
You're listening to QSO. And we'll be right back with our guest, shortwave radio legend Alan Weiner, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. LightPack Induction Lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%, with this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs, as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, LightPackSystems.com. That's LightPackSystems.com, spelled LightPackSystems. LightPackSystems.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. You're listening to QSO. And now, back to our guest, shortwave radio legend, Alan Weiner.
And we promptly took the station, and it was kind of an interesting station. The antenna was located in downtown Presque Isle, literally 80 feet below sea level, just about. Well, below average terrain. So we promptly moved the antenna to Johnson Hill, which was a nice hilltop antenna site for communication towers, and boosted its coverage, you know, several orders of magnitude. And this was in 1980, and we went on for like the first 2 weeks with the rock and roll format, and that went nowhere. And then someone suggested to me that it might be good to try this new country music that was coming out around then. Remember that?
Now, what year was that?
1980.
I'm listening to your story, and I'm like, yeah, because that was the urban cowboy era. I think was coming.
That was the urban. That was when modern country was beginning to really become a force in this nation. And someone suggested that we take the FM and we go on with a modern country format. And so we did. We signed on WOZI, which is still on the air, by the way. Well, it's not country anymore. It's oldies, but no, it's not. It's oldies rock. That's what it is now. We signed it on the air. I forgot, sometime in mid 1980, with this new country format, 24 hours a day, and it took off like a wildfire. I mean, I love country music because the loyalty of listeners is astounding. I mean, they get fixed on your station, and they really will rip the knob off or cement it on your frequency, and that's all they'll listen to day and night. And we began playing a lot of the new country that was coming out then, together with a helping of a lot of the older classics and classic country tunes at the time, and some bluegrass. And people loved it, and the station did very, very, very well. But, you know, I always had an itch to do bigger and better broadcasting than being in Presque Isle, Maine. I mean, I'm still in northern Maine with the shortwave stations. But back then, the stations are doing okay. But I really wanted to get a radio station in a major metropolitan area like my hometown of New York City. And at that time, I was developing a relationship with the offshore radio people that were running Laser Radio and Radio Caroline in England. And I began contacting them and speaking with them, and I even went over and visited the ships and did some engineering for them and all that. And I said, well, you know, these guys and gals have been doing offshore radio off the coast of England since the 1960s. And mind you, this is like 1984. And they're still on the air. They were still on the air then. And I'm saying, well, you know, they're making millions of dollars doing this. Why wouldn't this work in international waters off the coast of the United States? And of course, you know, the U.S. being such a free and open society.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but why wouldn't this work? So in 1984, I set my goals that the next station that I'm going to build, because I always like to be building things. It's the only time I'm really happy is when I'm creating stuff. I think I'm going to try to build one of these offshore stations. So I began to do all kinds of research, you know, read up about ships and, you know, how to configure transmitters on them and, you know, what's involved with the upkeep and, you know, all the finances and budgets and everything. Of course, this is getting to be the mid-80s. The dollar was worth a lot more then, and you actually could do stuff and didn't have to speak about money in billions or trillions back then. So I began to make a plan to put a ship off the coast of New York City, a commercial venture, and get on the air. And I began to make it happen. I got some money together. Not much either. You know, I think about the money that we spent doing this project, and it was like nickels and dimes. It really was incredibly not much. But we're good at that here at WBCQ of, making... making good mash out of not much, turning lead into gold. I mean, we're used to that here at WBCQ, the planet. So we secured a ship in 1986 in the Boston Harbor area, and we spent pretty much the whole year half the year of 86 and half the year of 1987, equipping the ship with AM, FM, and shortwave transmitters and their appropriate antenna systems. And that, you know, just doing that could take a couple of these shows to explain all the trials and tribulations and everything we went through to get that happening.
Just out of curiosity, once you got a ship positioned, how long did it take you to travel from the shoreline out to the ship?
Well, the ship was only about, 3.5-4 miles off the coast of Long Beach, Long Island. So getting out there, you know, depending on how fast the boat is, took, 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. So you weren't way out in the water. You were only 3 or 4 miles out. I wondered.
No, because the international coastal limit back then, in 1987, when we brought our radio ship out, it was 3 miles. The fishing limit was 12 miles, but the international coastal limit was 3 miles, and it still was 3 miles. It's 12 miles today, thanks to us, but it was 3 miles back then. So in July of 1987, we got all our ducks in a row, and we got the registry of the ship, which was registered to Honduras. And we got on board, and we had the ship towed out there on a hot July day, third week in July. And we dropped anchor, just about 4 miles off the coast of Long Beach, Long Island, New York. And I might be getting the dates wrong, but I believe it was the 22nd of July, 1987. We fired up the diesels, and we went on the air, doing some test transmissions for about 6 hours, from 6 o'clock to midnight on 1620, 101.3 FM, 6275 shortwave, and 190 kilocycles longwave. So we had 4 transmitters going.
Longwave.
Yeah, I love longwave, transmission. Jennifer, my darling wife Jennifer, is a real, I didn't know Jennifer back then, but she's a real loafer. You know, there's a lot of people that really like longwave propagation and signals, and I've always been fascinated with longwave. I'm kind of sorry there was never a longwave broadcasting service allowed under international agreement here in the United States, because I just find longwave, very, very fascinating. I mean, that could be a separate subject and aside. But anyway, we went on the air, and we were on the air 2 days, and really, as we joke around, the ship hit the fan. The news media picked up on it, and we were being visited by every television, every radio network around. Of course, there was no internet then. There was no, blogging or Facebook or any of that, so it was all real-time interviews and helicopters and boats coming out there, and everybody on the ship was getting their 15 minutes of fame, freeze-dried, and we were kind of overwhelmed with it all. But we were on the air for 4 or 5 days, and then, the Coast Guard comes out, and the FCC comes out, and the FBI comes out, and all the alphabet soup agencies are out there, and 50-millimeter guns, just busting our behinds left and right. They seized the ship. They put me and the only people who were on board at the time, again, at 5:30 in the morning. Why at 5:30 in the morning? But anyway, Ivan and myself, Ivan Jeffries and myself, were the only two people on board at that early time, and they came. We weren't even on the air. They came and seized the ship illegally, put us in handcuffs, took us off, broke up all the equipment, cut transmission lines, smashed tubes, ripped out wiring, did all this stuff down below. They left the ship at anchor, but they took us to federal court. We got released in our own recognizance. And later on, after a month or so of legal haggling, all charges were dropped because they were all bogus, because we were not violating the law. We were in international waters. And, we tried a few times to bring the ship out again, but the government just kept throwing restraining orders and paper at us. They're good at that. Most people have never had to deal with the federal government on a level where when they don't want you to do something, even if you're right, if they really don't want you to do something, they will stop you. They will stop you any way that they can. And unless you have the protective veil of enough publicity, or, you know, I always used to joke that if Al Sharpton was on our ship, they wouldn't have touched us at all. They made it very, very difficult. We tried to get back on the air a number of times, and there was just so much legal paperwork and so much fighting in the courts that after a while I just gave up.
And what do you suppose was the hot button that made the government, even though you were legally outside of their jurisdiction, what made them so fire up and hell-bent to make sure that you guys got knocked off the air and made an example of?
I'll tell you exactly what it is, and it's word, control. They had no control over our radio stations. And to this government, and we see it now, you know, we see what's going on now. To this government, lack of control it brings them to the point of hysteria. And, I mean, radio is a very difficult thing to do. It's expensive. It's complex. It's not something that anyone with real money would do, because they could just go and buy a station somewhere and do it. You know, my situation was a little different. I didn't have much money, but I had knowledge. I know how to do things. So we got a ship at surplus prices. We built all of our own equipment. We put it out there for nickels and dimes. I think the whole project cost probably around $100,000, which to some people might sound like a lot of dough, but when you're trying to build anything, especially today, from a commercial venue, that ain't a lot of money. So it boiled down to that. They had no control over it, and they were petrified. It's the old thing that you always used to hear in schools, you know, like when you were a kid in school. Well, if we let you do it, we'll have to let everybody else do it. And there's a lot of that mentality. You know, the government is people like us, you know, and we don't always sometimes make the best choices or decisions, or, you know, we don't always apply justice and fairness in the correct way, because we're not perfect. Only God is perfect. I mean, we're not. So it was a control issue, and they were bound and determined not to let it happen. So I gave up. Well, I put it aside. I put it aside in a box and said, not now. And that's when I started to think about, well, wait a minute. What about this wonderful venue known as shortwave radio, which I always knew about, which, of course, we had a small 300-watt shortwave station on board the ship, which the days that it was on, we got reception reports from all over the world on our 6275 frequency for Radio New York International when it went on the air of July of 87. So I thought more about it. And after, you know, it's interesting, after all that stuff happened, the one thing it did do, the notoriety we got out of it got me and my partner a job at ABC Television, working in the engineering department. So while we were, you know, futzing around with the courts and deciding what was going to happen with the ship, we got really excellent jobs at ABC, making good money and working with television. So at least something, you know, constructive was coming out of it. Met a lot of fascinating people. Had a lot of fun. That's one thing I love about radio. Radio is fun. It's a fun thing. When you really get into it, the people you meet and the situations you get into, we've definitely had a great time. There were some harrowing moments there, but it was a lot of fun. But so while I was at ABC and we were waiting to see what was going to happen with our radio ship thing, I started seriously thinking about shortwave. And I said, well, why don't I start the process? So I started doing research and making phone calls and speaking to my FCC attorneys and all that. And that was, when was that, 88, 89? And they were pretty, my attorneys were pretty honest with me. They were saying, well, if you think the FCC is going to give you a license now, it's probably not going to be plan A for them. So we tendered applications, and it took a while. Actually, it took from, what did it, took from like 1988 to about, it took about 10 years of, you know, legality and legal finagling and situations with the ships and all this stuff to finally get granted a construction permit to build WBCQ in December of 1998, because I had thought about it logically, and I had said, well, what are we trying to do? What were we trying to do with the offshore stations? We wanted to cover a large area of people, like New York City. We wanted to bring free speech radio to the air. We wanted to get all kinds of different people on the air, different kinds of music, different kinds of political and social viewpoints. We really wanted to be a truly free speech, uncontrolled outlet. So I said, well, what's the next best thing? Well, of course, the next best thing would probably be putting up my own satellite or whatever, but, you know, that's like $1 billion. Nobody has that money except Ted Turner. So that's not practical. What's the next practical thing? Well, what about shortwave? Shortwave is great. You stick a transmitter somewhere, you beam out 50 kilowatts, and you could cover the whole planet. And people could, you know, with a good signal and good propagation, I mean, people could pick you up on a shortwave radio, you get in a bubble pack for $10. I said, well, this is, you know, again, this is the 1980s. I'm saying there was no internet. There was no nothing. And I'm saying, well, this is the way to go. So I convinced a lot of my friends that. So we began the process of doing that and filed the applications. In the meantime, my buddies and I were getting itchy to get on the air, and I got a letter. I got a letter in the mail from George. And you know who I'm talking about.
George McClintock.
Right. I got a letter in the mail from George in 1990. I got a letter from George McClintock, God bless him. And he had heard about what we were doing with the ship, and he had heard about, you know, our programming and what we were trying to accomplish. And he wrote me a really nice letter, and he said, look, why don't you lease time on our newly constructed shortwave station, WWCR, and, you know, why don't you bring your Radio New York International to our stations? I remember I got the letter, I'm reading it, and I'm saying, this is a great idea. So I went to all my buddies, I went to JP, went to Randy, went to all the people that we were involved with, and I said, you know, we should do this. So we, so I contacted George, worked out a rate. And within, I guess, a month or so, we got everything set up, and we signed on. I forgot the date. It was in 1990. We took to the air on WWCR for 4 hours on Sunday night from 8 p.m. to midnight. What was it? What was their first frequency? It was in 7,500-something. And we got on the air, and it was, you know, it was a great hit. I mean, it was a... You know, we had notified people, and people were just listening all over the country, all over the world. It was a great thing, and it was a lot of fun. And meantime, you know, while this was going on, I was working at ABC, making some good money there. I was trying to get licensed for my own shortwave station, but, you know, God bless WWCR. They put us on the air, and we started doing a lot of programming there. And we stayed on CR as long as we could. They were charging us per hour a hell of a lot more than what I charge people today. But that's okay. I understand. You know, it was a different time, and you know, they wanted to make money. And actually, George did cut us a deal eventually. A year or so later, helped us out a bit. But the main goal I had was getting my own shortwave station, because I had the land up here in northern Maine, perfect place, and had the know-how, had the people, Certainly was learning about the equipment, you know, how to convert 50-kilowatt AM transmitters to 50-kilowatt shortwave transmitters. You know, met good old Radio Timtron. My brother in arms in the radio arts, our master engineer, and finally, you know, this is all going on, and then, you know, Ted, there's so much I can't remember it all. In the midst of all this, in the mid, you know, we're on CR, and we're broadcasting, and I got a phone call. I got to bring this up because this is significant. I got a phone call, I guess maybe the first 6 months that we were doing the WWCR gig in the early 90s. I got a phone call from a guy in Kansas, and his name was Scott Becker. You know Scott, don't you?
I'm familiar with who he is, but I don't know him personally.
All right. Well, I got a call from this guy, Scott Becker. Fascinating fellow. He said that he had a satellite network, and he wanted to put our stations on satellite. And I said, fine, you know, put our signal on satellite, which he did. You know, he was leasing satellite time. So he would pick up our signal either off the air or via phone line, because there were no internet feeds back then. And he put us on the Becker satellite system. And as I got to know Scott, you know, he knew that we were trying to get a shortwave station. And, you know, he was very fascinated with the offshore thing, and he kind of said, well, maybe we should try it again. And I said, well, we can try it again, but, you know, I'm out of dough. I mean, we got to raise money. Scott knew Brother Stair of the Overcomer Ministry. Good man. And in fact, Scott was responsible for getting Brother Stair on shortwave. Because he told me, he said, you know, I know this fellow. His name is Brother Stair. I helped him get on shortwave a short while ago. And he's a good man, and he's a good preacher, and he might be interested in financing a offshore radio station. So we met with him, and we spoke with him, and, we came up with a plan to outfit a big fishing trawler with shortwave transmitters and bring it down to, like, Belize or some other friendly country and transmit, you know, all over the world on simultaneous shortwave channels. And that's when the Voyager Broadcast Systems, the Voyager Project, started. And so in the early 90s, by 1992, my gig at ABC had ended, and my partner at that time, besides Scott, was my friend JP, and we got involved with buying and running a small AM radio station up in Hyde Park, New York, on 950 AM. So if you can keep track of this all, because as I remember it, the 1990s were a very, very busy time for me in broadcasting.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was, you know, actively trying to get a shortwave station. We were just about to embark on building another legal offshore radio station, and I was also involved with operating with my partner JP. An AM commercial AM station in Hyde Park, New York. So, you know, I'm juggling all this stuff, hoping that one of them hits the jackpot. But the Voyager project was very interesting. Brother Stair is a wonderful guy. We're still friends to this day. And he put up the money, the Overcomer Ministry put up the money, to outfit a 150-foot offshore fishing trawler that, again, we purchased used in Boston. And we fitted out with four shortwave transmitters, one AM transmitter, and I think we had an FM transmitter on board, but that wasn't hooked up yet. And we were going to bring that down to the Caribbean and broadcast with it. Well, we were pretty much getting ready to bring it down, And unfortunately, someone started doing, well, this is what the government claimed, started doing some radio transmissions from on board the ship. They were transmitting, the alleged programs were everything from Johnny Lightning and Radio New York International programs to other music programs, which didn't happen, but that's what they alleged. So, again, at 5:30 in the morning, why 5:30 in the morning? The federal government comes and busts the Fury, that was the name of the ship, in Charleston Harbor. We had brought the ship down to Charleston for final finishing. And this is in 1992. And so they stage a raid, and they take over the ship. Nobody got arrested. Nobody got arrested on this. They just seized the ship and, again, just totally wrecked it and dismantled it. And basically said, well, if you want your equipment back, you'll have to prove that no illegal activity was done with it. And, of course, everything, you know, belonged to Brother Stair and the Overcomer Ministry, and, you know, he, did some legal research on it and tried to get the equipment back, and, you know, it became to be the old adage, you know, you'll have to spend $100,000 to get back $50,000, if you understand what I mean. So that project went by the wayside. But again, you know, no one was arrested or whatever, and there's still a lot of mystery going on to exactly what happened. But it goes down to answering your question of about a half an hour ago. They just do not want offshore radio stations being built or used or tested or anything here in the United States of America. So that was offshore station project number two. And yeah, there was a number three, the Electra project, but I don't think there's enough time to get into that.
Well, now, let me ask you a question. Were you absolutely certain that no one was transmitting on that ship?
Yeah. The ship was basically dead. The generators had a problem. No. To this day, I am confused and confounded to exactly... I mean, I have my suspicions of what did occur, but I can't prove it. So we just pretty much have to leave it as an unknown. The only thing I can say is Brother Stair of the Overcomer Ministry, who's been on BCQ for years and years and years, and of course Brother Stair has been a staple of international shortwave, and I know the man personally as the prophet of God, and he is sincere, he's a great man, and he does great work, and the Overcomer is the radio service and the shortwave service is a great service. And the Fury project, the Voyager Broadcasting Service project, was a great project, and we all went through a lot, and it kind of met an early end, an unfair and unjust end. But that's what happens in this country when the government does not want you to do something, even if what you are doing is completely legal. And, you know, this is a warning out there to our listeners and to our friends that believe in democracy and believe in a constitutional republic. So we tried again, but again, even while we were doing this with Brother Stair and the Overcomer, I was still working with my attorneys trying to get licensed to with the FCC to build a domestic international shortwave station. Of course, the Fury project didn't make it any easier. It was kind of like, oh, yeah, you want a station now? The commission was treating me like Captain Hook, and they really didn't want to give me a license. But I stuck with it, and you know George Jacobs.
I know who he is. I've never met the man, but I'm very well...
George Jacobs is the father of modern shortwave radio. He's the one that got WRNO its license. He's the one that fought to get commercial shortwave in this country. He's a great engineer, he's a great man, and he's a great patriot. And he stuck with me. You know, he stuck with me through thick and thin. And between him and my attorney, Michael Cousins, out in California, we kept working with the government. And finally, in December of 1998, they granted me a construction permit to build an international shortwave station up here at my home in Monticello, Maine. And in many ways, I never thought it would happen, but it did. And there were multitudinous reasons why it did, why it happened, but mainly we stuck with it and got the construction permit, built the station in the summer of 1998, went on the air in September of 1998, and here we are today, still on the air, still doing free radio, still giving people like you with your fantastic programs, Radio Disclosure, QSO, all this great stuff that Ted Randall produces and puts on the air, to a worldwide listening audience. And am I bullish on shortwave radio? I am more bullish on shortwave radio today than I was 10 years ago, because I find shortwave radio more significant and important today as a real communication medium than I did 10 years ago, when there wasn't an internet and there were not as many alternative platforms of communication. So there, that's the short story, and there's a lot missing, but that's it.
Well, you know, we got a little time. Tell us about the third ship. You said you were going to get into that, but you didn't really want to take the time. And incidentally, for those who have just tuned in, we're talking to Alan Weiner. Alan is the owner of WBCQ, and he's had a tremendous career and lifeline in the radio business and the radio industry, the radio, what do I want to say? I guess I want to say radio way of life. The story he's telling is fascinating. And we'll have it back on the air again. And, of course, it'll be available on iTunes and Zune in the form of a podcast. If you've missed some of this and you're not sure when it'll re-air, we'll have it available for you. And we're also listening. You're listening to a radio program brought to you by the folks at Outlaw Gospel. And their website is just simply PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. And if you have needs of any kind, some spiritual needs, you need somebody to pray for your group of people, and you don't want folks invading your life, knocking on your doors and asking you for information, and you know, you don't want to write a check to somebody, you just simply want someone to pray for you, that's the website to go to, PrayForMe.us. Also, while you're listening right now, shoot us an email. You can do that at TedRandall@TedRandall.com, TedRandall. TedRandall@TedRandall.com, and when you do that, place on the email, I want to win, because we have drawings and we give away all kinds of things. So you might win something, and we will QSL if that's what you're looking for. Alan Weiner, talk about this third ship. Now, you've got me going. I want to hear this story.
Well, the third ship was called the Electra Project, and it was basically Dr. Becker and I. Scott and I are very passionate about offshore radio. You know, it's kind of like you tell a kid you can't do something and he wants to do it even more. So, you know, the original Radio New York International 1987, they blasted that off the air. The Fury Voyager Broadcast Service project of 1992, 1991, 1992 with Brother Stare and the Overcomer, they illegally destroyed that. So we said to, you know, I remember this was, 1997, before I got a shortwave license. Because at that time, I didn't think I was going to get licensed for shortwave in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, people were telling me, in your dreams. Even Howard Stern said to me, Alan, they're never going to give you a license. And that's it. Just get used to it. So, but, you know, I stuck with it. But anyway, so we were going to try another offshore station. This time we were going to be very careful. We'll have, you know, security, make sure there's no transmitters, nothing fooling around. So we secured an offshore, an ocean-going tug. We bought an ocean-going tugboat, very tough. And we were going to fit that out with a couple of shortwave transmitters. And Scott was making arrangements with the government of St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean. And we figured if we're going to do this, we might as well kind of have fun. So we were going to take the ship and anchor it right in the island, you know, within their territorial limits. So, I mean, it wouldn't be illegal in any way, shape, or form. And we were making plans to do that. And we outfitted this tugboat in Boston. And unfortunately, we tried, but the best way to explain it is we ran out of money. because, as I said, it takes a lot of money to run diesel fuel. The ship was moving from Boston down south in preparation to going to the Caribbean. And the ship developed some problems. It got some water in its fuel. The captain was having trouble with the boat. The boat got laid up. And finally, we just ran out of dough. We just ran out of money. So we canceled the project and sold all the assets. And that was it. That was it. We were, at the moment, done with the offshore radio thing.
Well, you know, I guess I wonder how you lasted as long. I can't even imagine the amount of discouragement when you know you're doing something that's technically correct, you're not breaking the law, and the government comes in and just, you know, just does whatever they want to do. And the majority of people in the United States, they don't know any better. I mean,
they don't. You know, the problem was, there were several problems. Number one is we just did not have enough funding. I mean, yeah, we could build it. Yeah, we could bring it somewhere and make it operational. But when you're doing a controversial thing like that, you know, you need protection. I mean, you need some kind of either get protection because you're in the public eye so much, so nobody's going to do anything to you, or you have enough financing or money where you can lawyer up, as they say, and shield yourself from you know, illegal government activity. And we just didn't have that. We just were, you know, I was younger and I was more naive. I said, well, it's such a nice thing, it's such a good, harmless thing to do, we're not breaking any laws or anything, so leave us alone. And it just wasn't going to happen. So that last offshore time, was it 1997, we pretty much shelved the offshore thing. And, of course, if somebody wants to give me $5 million, I'll build another radio ship for them, and we'll put it out and have a good time. But in today's world, that's about what it would take.
It almost makes you wish that someone would come along and go out the legal limit again, you know, off the coastline of the United States, out into international waters. Somebody with some deep pockets, and fight the federal government until they make false charges, and then file suits against those people and have them put away.
Well, you know, it's theoretically all possible, but it just takes it. Ted, if there's one thing I've learned in business, a lot of it takes money. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sweat that you got to put into it, and a lot of gusto and dedication. But boy, you really got to have that working capital. You really do.
The other thing,
especially when you start dealing with boats and federal agencies and things like that, you know, you really need the bread. You really do. You either need the bread or the notoriety. As I always used to joke around, I mean, if Al Sharpton was on our radio ship running it back in 1987, we'd probably still be on the air. So, you know, you need backing like that. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, if not, if you don't have a shield like that, you know, the government comes in and they, as my attorney said, they just throw paper at you. When they really don't want you to do something, they just start throwing paper at you and putting restraining orders on what you do. And if you don't have enough money and if you don't have enough lawyers to fight them, you know, and if you're doing something that's way out controversial like this that really threatens their control, this is what happens. So it's better to join them. So in 1998, after 10 years of haggling, you know, we finally got licensed to construct a shortwave station, and here we are today. Okay. And I'm very, and in all fairness, and I got to admit this, in the 12 years, going on 12 years that BCQ has been on the air, the government, the FCC, they've been very cooperative and very good with us. And I have no complaints. I really don't. You know, and when I think about it, I said, all right, I'm playing a game. You know, we're playing the game here at BCQ. You know, we got the ticket. We got the license. We're on the air. Our programmers pretty much say and do anything they want. No one has ever called me up to ask me to restrain any of our programmers or statements. And I think, you know, God bless my country for that. I mean, you know, we're playing by the rules, and we expect the rules to apply to everyone. We operate BCQ, under the First Amendment of the Constitution, the right of free speech. And we don't limit or censor our programmers, and we defend their right to say what they want, and that's it. And we give people a free speech voice. We've had hundreds and hundreds of people on our station over this last 12 years that would have never had an opportunity to broadcast to a great many ears out there, and we've changed a lot of people. I hope we've improved the lives of our listeners and helped raise their awareness, bring some enjoyment, bring some hope into their life. BCQ is a unique station. It really is a Ma and Pa thing. I mean, I'm Pa. You can tell I'm getting tired. I'm Pa, Jennifer's Ma, and, you know, we've got definitely the most eclectic crew on the planet, all kind of semi-retired engineers. You know, we got Tom, you know, Tom Barna running the station, and you know, he's kind of our running chief engineer up here. And as I said, Tim Tron's our master engineer. I don't consider him our chief engineer. I consider him the master engineer. And he keeps the transmitters and everything humming and buzzing along just fine. And most of the people here work for nothing, you know, because there really, you know, there isn't much money in this business. I mean, there's enough to pay the bills and everything, but it's definitely not the way to fatten up the bank account. But we love it.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, shortwave radio legend Alan Weiner, right after this. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas,
and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support.com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email. And go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L, and we'll look for your email. You're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, shortwave radio legend, Alan Weiner.
All broadcasters have a certain responsibility to at least turn their facilities over to someone or some group that would provide that service.
You would think.
you would think, and in all fairness, I know that there are many radio stations out there that really go above and beyond the call of duty when there's a disaster, be it a big snowstorm or a flood or some horrible thing, and they just turn their facilities over 24/7 for people to listen to locally. I know there are many stations that do that, and there are still many ma and pa local stations. There's 17,000 AM FM and there's 17,000 AM FM and television stations throughout this great land. And a lot of them you don't hear about. They're just going about their daily business, providing local information to their community. Yeah, a lot of them are automated now. A lot of them are run by a computer and don't do that. But a lot of them are there, for the community and will continue to remain. I know here in New England, we have many of them. We have many of them here in the state of Maine. We got many of them around the Boston area. And they're staples, like WBZ out of Boston, which is on 10:30 a.m. with one of the best. They're on 10:30, which is kind of the upper middle of the dial position. And they've got one of the best AM signals I've ever heard. But they're 50,000 watts on 10:30. I mean, that station goes everywhere. And that's what everybody tunes into, you know, whenever there's a problem.
Well, you know,
what they tune into, and they depend on it.
I said a long time ago that when the skies go dark and you're driving in your car, the radio station that you first instinctively tune to is the winner in town because they have the most credibility. Is the winner. In other words, when you're driving along in town, let's say you're in Boston or you're in Chicago, wherever you live.
Oh, the winner. Oh, yeah, the winner.
And,
okay.
And when the skies turn dark and you immediately say, oh, I don't know what's going on. Let me tune in W, blah, 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 whatever. And you hit the button on that radio and tune there because you know that that station is responsible and they're going to give you information as soon as they possibly can. But you see, in this town, we don't have that.
Somebody's got to do it because if they do that, they'll have a winner. I mean, they'll be sold out. I mean, BZ is a powerhouse. I mean, they make more money than most radio stations in the country.
The two powerhouses,
because they're always there.
The two powerhouse AM stations in Nashville are just eking out a meager existence, and I think the reason why is you can only downsize so far, and they're down to skeleton crews. Matter of fact, the one 50,000-watt, you'll listen at night. Sometimes the computer will mess up, and they'll have dead air for 3 hours. Nobody knows. You know, I mean, I don't even want to get into this anymore.
I mean, it's got to be a dynamite market. I mean, I find that unusual.
You would think, well, it's not. And from what I understand, the situation also exists in a number of other markets like this. So it's not. It's maybe. You're blessed where you're at because out here in this part of the country and in a lot of towns similar to Nashville, this is pretty well near become the status quo. I mean, I can't imagine an unattended station to start with or an unattended group where you have four or five stations and nobody home. But that's the way it is. And see, to me,
I think someone needs to take. You know, an AM talker or something in that area and get a reputation as the place to be during a natural emergency. I find it astounding, but, you know, let the marketplace fix it. Let the marketplace decide. Let the marketplace fix it.
Well, I think we're moving in a direction, though, what I think is happening, and that is that radio stations have become places of extreme boredom. I think people are bored with domestic radio. I think that also explains the resurgence of shortwave listenership. People, they're going to look somewhere for something. And I think they want to hear live things. I think they want to hear real people on the air live. I think they want to hear that.
Well, I do know this. I do know this. There is an adage in radio broadcasting, and I believe in this firmly. If you give somebody something good to listen to, they will seek it out and listen to it. Yeah, radio, we've seen it, Ted, because we've been in the business. The last 20 years, I have seen what I call the homogenization of radio, where a lot of your stations, they're satellite connected, internet connected now, and they're pretty much doing the same playlist and all voice tracks. Not real people there. And yeah, there's a blandness, there's a, as I say, homogenization, whipping up and making it all kind of be like one. But that's a perfect opportunity, especially in a decent-sized market where there's, you know, a good market, you know, market, where there's a share of good advertising dollars. That, to me, sounds like a perfect opportunity with someone with a decent signal in that market. Come forward and provide a needed service to the area. And considering all the storms and problems that have been going on in the South and in this country, which we have to some degree just about everywhere, I find it astounding in any good-sized market, even in a small market, there's got to be one radio station that leads the pack on providing local news and information and topics needed by its citizens.
Well,
and
if
they're not, then, you know, people aren't screaming loud enough. The business climate has become so lackadaisical or stupid that they just don't see it.
I think the apathy runs way too high, and I think that the point, I think almost that this radio market has reached a place of point of no return, in that the listeners don't expect it anymore. They're not used to it. They don't expect it. They're not even looking for it anymore. I think they've pretty well given up.
Well, that's a shame. That's a loss of a resource for the listeners.
The other thing,
loss of a great business opportunity for a smart broadcaster.
Well, one prime example was the flooding we had here, and I mean everything was underwater here.
One
of the radio stations I take care of was completely and totally underwater.
I know, terrible disaster.
And yet, one of our 50,000 waters, and I won't mention their call sign because I'm not trying to throw rocks. They were signing off at midnight. You know, and it's like you had people that were completely run out of their homes. You had people staying in anywhere they could find a place to stay. And there was relief things coming in, and there was information that people were looking for. They were trying to figure out, where can I get this? Where can I get water? Where can I get this? You know, and this thing went off the air at midnight, and I thought to myself, what in the world are they thinking?
I don't know. That's insanity. I can hardly believe it.
You know, so
I mean, you know, if I had a station in a market like that, even if it was 500 watts, I mean, I'd have it on 24/7. You know, taking in information and news, and have people call in and share information. You know, just my philosophy. You know, it's interesting what I feel about broadcasting, like with WBCQ, because a lot of people sometimes wonder why we do what we do, because we put a lot of effort into it and really don't make that much out of it. And my philosophy has always been with broadcasting. If you can help one person, one listener, either, you know, help them with what they're doing or save them with something or bring some enjoyment into their life, just one person, just one, then you have accomplished your goal, then you have succeeded, and you keep going on. So I what you're telling me now from a broadcaster standpoint, I find shocking. I really do.
Well, nonetheless,
and if broadcasting is getting that apathetic, then those stations will just, you know, turn into nothing. I mean, people will stop listening to them, and therefore the advertisers will clue in, and they'll realize, well, nobody listens to WXYB or Z or whatever it is, and we're not going to advertise. And then they'll go off the air, and then they'll hand in their license, and you know, or sell it to someone else that maybe will do a better job. As I said, I know. I speak to people that run small little stations in markets here in New England that have... in fact, I was talking with a fellow in the Rhode Island area who just bought an AM station, I think on 1230, 1 kilowatt. And they are doing everything to service the community. They are doing local sports. They're doing local news. They're doing local garage sales. They're doing local remotes. They're on the air constantly, constantly to service the community. Because when they do that, the potential clients see it. They see, well, this station is everywhere and is doing everything. So I've got to advertise on them because they're everywhere and they're doing everything, and everybody's tuning in to hear what they're doing.
Now, see, we've got. I'm thinking of one radio station in Franklin, Tennessee, and I'll just say who they are: WAKM 950. They do a superlative job, and I think they're 5,000 watts or something like that. But they're Franklin, so if you're in another part of town, the north end of Nashville or something, you're not going to be able to pick them up at night. But in their community, they work so hard and they do so much. But they're not hurting financially either, like the big stations.
Well, they shouldn't. They should be rewarded for their efforts because it sounds like they're managed well.
We have a small FM in Lebanon here where I'm at. And they put more effort into what they do than any of the Nashville stations. That's just the way it is. They put more effort, and I believe they actually have a much more loyal following. And if I were a businessman and I were going to place my advertising dollars somewhere, I'd put it on AKM in Franklin. I'd put it on this one here in Lebanon, you know, because I know that the audience responds to a responsible resourceful broadcaster. That's just all there is
well,
to
I'll
it.
Tell you, I'll tell you, there's going to be, we're seeing it now, there's going to be huge shakeouts of radio stations throughout the country. The stations that are just operating as in the, like in the old days, as just money buckets, you know, where they just, you know, program the computer and run the music and that's it. They're going to have a harder and harder time connecting with their audience and convincing potential clients that they're being listened to and taken seriously. But the stations that are tuned, that are local, that are tuned into the community, that are serving the community, that are becoming, you know, that are staying a social force in the community, they will get the backing of the marketplace and they will stay on the air. So yeah, you're going to see a lot of stations that are just going to be idled along, and some of them will hang it up and hand in their license or sell it to somebody else who might have a different idea. But let the marketplace decide; it'll happen. We're seeing it now. I mean, we're seeing it in markets all around the United States. Radio is changing, and yeah, there are competitive platforms out there. People can, you know, take their little MP3 player. And they can get on the internet, and they can download all, you know, thousands, I mean, a whole library of music on their little MP3 player. Plus, they can log, you know, download blogs of programs and news and information and listen to it at their leisure. So, yeah, the competitive edge for local radio is higher, so they have to work harder to keep the listeners loyal to what they're doing. But I do know this. People remain loyal to their local radio stations. If they feel that their local radio station cares about them and is out there doing stuff for them, they will have listeners. And if they have listeners, they'll have clients buying airtime. It's as simple as that. That's the way it always used to be. You know?
Well, I think we're in a situation now, though, too. I think where a lot of folks are tuning in on shortwave because of the mundaneness of AM and FM at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, shortwave, you know, shortwave has always been this mysterious, eclectic, you know, far out, far away service. You know what happens whenever there's a, God forbid, you know, catastrophe. Like, you know, God forbid we get into another war or something like that. There's always a spike in shortwave radio. Always. Whenever there's a major world problem, people are running out buying more and more shortwave radios. I don't want to see that happen for the reason to increase our listenership, but it's just a fact of shortwave radio life. Now, why is this? Because people tune the shortwave dial looking, as you said, for the other side of the story. For something different, to get away from the mundane. And that's why BCQ is here. That's why we're doing fine. That's why our listenership continues to grow. Every time we flick our plate switch on and our transmitters go on, we get new emails all the time, and we get new QSLs from people that somebody gave them a shortwave radio, or they bought a shortwave radio, and they tune around, and they pick up the station, and they go, wow, this is the first time we heard you. And this happens every day, every hour, every minute that we're on the air, and I think it's going to become more and more, because it is so immediate, it is so inexpensive, not to do, but to listen to. And, you know, shortwave radio is going to remain with us for a long, long time. It's an older platform, but it is just so inexpensive to access, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, there are still a lot of people that like DXing and sucking signals out of the air. I got a letter from a 10-year-old DXer that listens to BCQ all the time because he just likes the station, and he enjoys hearing the different programs, and he loves tuning a shortwave radio in. It's just fun.
Well, you know what? I think I've worn out my welcome here. You and I have, as they say, talked the hind legs off the proverbial mule, so to speak. I think we've done it in.
What do you think? It's always look, Ted, it's always a pleasure talking with you, and it's always a pleasure talking about radio. I love the art. I consider it an art form. I consider the art, radio, the art and process of communicating using electromagnetic radiation transmitted through space. To me, it's still an art form. In fact, as a radio historian, every time that I read old engineering journals and engineering magazines from back in the 20s and 30s, the people that built the networks and built the stations, they refer to it as the radio art.
Well, and it is an art form. It really and truly is, you know.
It is. And that, it's a wonderful art form that has, you know, radio is really the marvelous application of electronics, which we now enjoy everything from computers to giant screen TVs. It's all in the same basket. But radio is the great, great, great granddaddy of it all. And it's still very viable and it's still very potent because I'll tell you, folks, no matter what happens, you know, if the power goes out, the internets go down, the infrastructure goes away, as long as somebody can fire up a transmitter into an antenna, and as long as you got a couple of pen light batteries or a couple of C cells, you know, and pull out that whip antenna, you'll get us. You'll get the communications. It'll still be there. It's part of the infrastructure, and it's going to stay.
Well, happy birthday, Alan Weiner. I really have enjoyed this, and I'm so happy we were able to get on and talk and kind of tell your story. And, of course, you know this show is going to air a number of times in different locations. So,
well, you know, it's a pleasure. And by the way, you do great radio.
Oh, thank you.
Your QSO and radio disclosure shows, which air several times on WBCQ, and folks, you can go to the website WBCQ.com and click on schedules and get the full schedule of it. Of course, Ted'll be happy to tell you anyway all the different times that his programs are on. And you do a great service to the ham radio community, the shortwave listener community, and the broadcast community with your wonderful programs here. You're a true radio head. Yes, you are, and God bless you.
Well, God bless you, sir, and I thank you so much for coming on with us. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com, and send us an email.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I Want to Win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I Want to Win. Go to QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. That wraps up this QSO. We want to thank you for listening, and a special thank you to our guest, Alan Weiner, for joining us today. This is QSO.